You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
So, thank you very much. Great to see so many of you here today. Two important facts to begin with. One is today is Ukraine's Independence Day. It's 33 years since Ukraine became independent from the Soviet Union in 1991. Gorom Slava, thank you. And the other fact is the sun is shining for our panel at Greenbelt. So I take that as an omen for us, for Ukraine. So just to explain, as Mark was saying, I'm a foreign correspondent on The Guardian. I'm the author of several non-fiction books. I've had quite a kind of variegated career where I've done a lot of conflict reporting. I started off as The Guardian's correspondent in Delhi. I covered the war in Afghanistan first time round. I did all of George W. Bush's delinquent wars in the noughties. I was in Iraq. I did a spell in Berlin with side trips to Baghdad. And then in the summer of 2006, my then boss came to see me in Berlin and we went for a meal. And she said to me rather enigmatically, we think you need a bigger canvas. We think you need a bigger canvas. And I said, well, what does that mean? And she said, Moscow. And basically no one had applied for the job in Moscow. And they decided that I needed a bigger canvas was kind of go to Russia. So, I mean, I consider myself to be pretty versatile. I reported from conflict zones. My wife, who is in the audience towards the back, is rather cool and independent. And we thought it would be an adventure, which it certainly was, but of the kind of darkest kind. And we started learning Russian, arrived in Moscow in early 2007. And I thought rather naively that Russia was what you might call a sort of semi-democracy. Not a full democracy, but moving slowly, inevitably towards some kind of more progressive identity. And it turned out that actually it was the reverse, that it had been a semi-democracy under Boris Yeltsin in the 1990s, and really under the stewardship of Vladimir Putin, a former KGB guy, although of course everyone knows there's no such thing as former in the KGB, it had regressed into this sort of neo-Soviet authoritarian state where I spent a lot of my time reporting on opposition protesters who would demonstrate against the government, against the regime, and were beaten up. I investigated top-level corruption. I asked the unwelcome question, how much money does Vladimir Putin have? Answer, he's the richest man in the world with the whole state at his disposal. And I traveled to the North Caucasus where there was a kind of underreported war going on between Islamists and federal and local security forces with enormous brutality on both sides. And the reward for basically telling the story of Russia and its slide into darkness was that Phoebe, my wife, and I found ourselves in really a kind of spy thriller, but a very badly written spy thriller. So if you're thinking John le Carré, throw John le Carré in the bin, because it was banal, it was repetitive, it was pretty spooky. We had a series of break-ins at our family apartment where goons belonging to the FSB, the successor agency to the KGB, would leave really dumb clues that they'd been in there to try and intimidate us. I had, someone listening to our phone calls. Again, not like in the movies, but it was made obvious that they were listening. So I would make a joke about Vladimir Putin, say, and the line would be cut immediately, and I'd hear, so what do? You make another joke about Vladimir Putin, and then, on one occasion, I was summoned to Lefortovo prison which is a KGB sort of detention center where Evan Gershkovitz, the American journalist recently freed in the spy swap, was held in the underground cells for more than a year. And I was interrogated by an FSB colonel. And so it was clear to me that what was happening behind the scenes was that the spy agencies, the FSB, which in Soviet times were subordinate to the Communist Party, to the Politburo, were running Russia, and under Putin had become a sort of new nobility. And I think there were sort of two projects going on. One was the sort of kleptocratic project where Russian officials were trying to steal as much as they could. And the ones at the top who were good at this game are now worth billions and billions of dollars. And the other project was ideological. It was to make Russia great again, to coin a phrase, to restore empire, imperial greatness, and to make Russia, as Putin saw it, a kind of co-equal to the United States, a superpower once more after a pretty humiliating decade in the 1990s. And what was interesting was I sort of saw this close up. Probably most of you have forgotten, but there was a small war in August of 2008 in Georgia when Russian tanks basically swept into Georgia. They didn't go as far as the capital, Tbilisi, but they smashed up the Georgian army. And I reported that story and was very unpopular with the kind of Russian authorities. But what was interesting about it was that Dmitry Medvedev, who at that point was briefly Russia's president, articulated this doctrine where he said that Russia had what he called privileged interests in what Russians call the near abroad. So former post-Soviet states like Ukraine, like the Baltic states, like Georgia, and so on. And essentially, what he was saying was that these states, Ukraine in particular, were not sovereign entities. They were not real countries. And that Moscow, as the big brother, could decide what their foreign policy was, what their security policy was, and essentially was treating them as provinces. And this is very much how the Russian political elite think. And after the war in Georgia, I went back to Moscow and people were whispering about Crimea. They were talking about Crimea, how Crimea was really Russian, even though we were talking about Ukrainian independence. In 1991, Crimea voted overwhelmingly to be separate from Russia and part of Ukraine. And I remember traveling to Simferopol, the regional capital, and doing a kind of speculative piece for The Guardian about how easy it would be for Russian troops who were based there with the Black Sea Fleet to raise the Russian tricolor above Sevastopol and to seize Crimea, and without actually thinking it would happen. And of course, 4 years later, it did happen in 2014. We saw protests in Kiev against a brutal, corrupt, pro-Russian president, Viktor Yanukovych, and Yanukovych having shot dead, or his security forces shot dead more than 100 people in the center of Kiev, he fled to Russia. And Putin, who was infuriated by the fact that Ukraine was basically moving, swinging in a Western direction, in a European direction, annexed Crimea and really pushed the button on what you might call a kind of clandestine or covert takeover of the east of Ukraine, the industrial Donbass region, which was traditionally Russophone, quite Soviet in its thinking, not everybody, but some people. And I went back to Ukraine in 2014, and I was based in Donetsk, the regional capital. I went to Luhansk, and it was extraordinary seeing how Russia took over surreptitiously. So you'd be driving through these rather forlorn mining villages in the east of Ukraine, and there'd be local pro-Russian guys, many of them teenagers, who would stop you at a checkpoint with baseball bats and balaclavas. And it was all a bit amateur hour. And you would come back, you'd drive the same road 4 days later, and then suddenly there would be a professionally built military checkpoint with someone else, slightly older, wearing a new uniform, no insignia, holding a brand new Kalashnikov. And these were basically undercover Russian special forces who choreographed a takeover of state institutions, of village halls, of the whole area, and began the war in Ukraine. I mean, we have to remember the war in Ukraine began in 2014. It didn't begin in 2022. And there was this kind of smoldering conflict where people died. About 12,000-13,000 Ukrainians were killed before 2022 in this war. By this point, I've been booted out of Russia. I was expelled in 2011. I'm on a blacklist. The Russian Foreign Ministry published about 30 British writers and journalists it really doesn't like. A couple of summers ago, I was number 24. So I'm banned. So long as Putin is there, I'm banned from Russia. And I was reporting from London. I wrote books about the murder of Alexander Litvinenko. I wrote a book about Donald Trump and Russia called Collusion, which was a New York Times bestseller. In 2019, I went back to Kiev to report on a comedian called Volodymyr Zelensky, who was going into politics. And the storyline was so crazy, we kind of wrote it slightly as a joke because, as you'll know, he was the star of a show called Servant of the People, about a school teacher who rants about corruption in his classroom. One of his pupils films him, puts it online, it goes viral, and then he stands to be actual president of Ukraine. This isn't Servant of the People. And of course he wins. And so this everyman nice guy becomes leader of a country of 45 million people. So Zelensky then registered Servant of the People as a political party. He campaigned and he won 73%. And it seemed one of those kind of meta storylines written by Netflix scriptwriters, a bit like a corrupt pseudo-billionaire American property magnate and reality TV show guy becoming president of America. I mean, that's never going to happen, right? Yeah, except it did, and same with Zelensky. And what's interesting, I mean, I saw Zelensky in May and interviewed him for The Guardian, but back then, he was the candidate of peace. He stood on a peace platform and basically said, if you'll let me, I will sit down with Vladimir Putin at a table. I think he didn't have in mind the kind of 5-meter-long table that Vladimir Putin uses these days. But we will end the war in the Donbass. We will bring peace, and you can get on with your lives and your families and so on. And the rival, his incumbent rival, was more a kind of war guy, Petro Poroshenko. Anyway, Zelensky won, and what was interesting and what I kind of charted was that Zelensky's attempts to deal with Putin went nowhere. Ukraine would make small concessions. Russia would take these concessions and continue killing Ukrainian soldiers on the line of contact, on the front line in the east. So if you then fast forward to 2021, and ominous things were going on. First of all, in spring of 2021, and then in the autumn of 2021, Russia began this enormous buildup of armor, of equipment, of blood banks of fuel vehicles, both in Belarus, in occupied Crimea, with self-propelled artillery vehicles trundling over the bridge that Putin had built across the Kerch Strait. And the whole world was trying to work out what was going on, whether this was a bluff, a negotiating tactic, something performative. I mean, clearly it was intimidation. And my view, having spent 4 years in Moscow, having been followed around by the secret police, was that with Vladimir Putin, if there's a bad option or a really terrible option, always bet on really terrible, because that's where you end up. So I was convinced that a storm was coming, a hurricane was coming towards Ukraine from the east. But a lot of people, a lot of Western politicians, didn't want to believe it. We had actually the Americans and the Brits, who had pretty good intelligence on this, telling Zelensky, telling his team, this is for real. There's going to be some kind of invasion. This is not a hoax. But then we had Emmanuel Macron, the French president, who in other ways is a very gifted politician, flying to Moscow, trying to reason with Putin, engage Putin with dialogue. But Putin was, by this point, in a kind of strange and messianic space. I don't know if any of you read the essay he wrote in the summer of 2021. Basically, he had a very bad lockdown. You know, not just the long table, not seeing anybody, but he decided that he was having been the guy on a horse with no top and the scuba diver and the person who cradled a tranquilized tiger, he was going to be an amateur historian. And he called up lots of books. I think he read some of these books. And he authored or co-authored an essay which basically went all the way back to the 9th century and said that Ukraine did not exist, that Ukraine and Belarus and Russia were a single, indivisible, spiritual, language and cultural space, and that Ukraine could not exist without Russia, and that the only reason Ukraine was independent was because various perfidious foreigners over the centuries had meddled in Russia's backyard, including the Poles, the Mongols who sat here from the mid-13th century, then the Germans around the First World War, and latterly the awful Anglo-Saxons, which is basically you lot, the Americans and the Brits, who had pushed Ukraine away from this Slavic unity into some kind of strange and alien space. And you know, I mean, I remember talking to a former emeritus professor of history at Cambridge about this essay, saying, how would you grade this essay? And he said, I would have given it a D or an E. It's unoriginal, it's tendentious, it's full of holes, it's dodgy. So you could dismiss it, apart from the fact this was a window into Vladimir Putin's strange and delusional mental world, in a regime where he had been a dictator for more than 20 years and he was surrounded by yes people who thought along similar lines. They believed that Ukraine was a rebellious province and that they were not invaders or thugs or barbarians, that they were somehow kind of restorationists who were bringing back something the West had split, bringing it back together again. So I'm in Kiev pretty solidly from late 2021. I've been there all the time ever since. Kiev was bizarre back then. Basically, no one wanted to believe it. Everyone wanted to believe that peace would somehow happen, that Putin would back down. I was very, very pessimistic. A lot of people were talking about Mariupol, which was about 20 kilometers from the front line, saying, look, we think we can defend Kiev, but Mariupol will be very hard. So I went to Mariupol. I made a film. I got shot at by a Russian sniper near the front line. The front line missed. The sniper missed, which is why I'm here. And I went to Avdiivka, another city in the east, and I was pretty gloomy. But I talked a bit about this yesterday. On the evening of the invasion, so February the 23rd, 2022, I was staying in a hotel in the historic center of Kiev, and I went out for dinner. I'd been invited to dinner by Andrei Kurkov, the Ukrainian novelist, brilliant guy, author of Death and the Penguin, Grey Bees, Diary of an Invasion, lots of brilliant books. And he invited me for a bowl of borscht. And I was running late. I had to file a story for The Guardian. And I went out into the center of Kiev on the eve of the invasion. And there were couples having dinner in restaurants. There was a good busker playing on a violin. There was a bad busker singing Oasis numbers. There were women selling tulips from plastic buckets. It was, you know, was and still is a vibrant European city with graffiti, with hipsters, with electric scooters, with artisanal pizza, with apps that you could order a taxi on and they would turn up immediately. A very digital society, progressive, European leading, European aspiring. And I went to go and see Kurkov and we chatted. By this point, quite a lot of people had left already. A lot of diplomats had gone, including the British ambassador. And at the end of the meal, we kind of hugged each other, and I went out into the street. And I took a call from a contact of mine in the Ukrainian foreign ministry who just said a few words. He just said, the invasion will begin at 4 a.m. The invasion will begin at 4 a.m. And he basically said, where you are is the wrong place. There will be Russian paratroopers coming in, there'll be gunfire, there will be attempts to storm the presidential administration, and you know, you might get killed. So think about going somewhere else. So I went back. I couldn't really sleep. About 4:15, I got a call from a colleague of mine saying it started. There were explosions on the edge of Kyiv. There were tanks had crossed the border from Belarus. There was another parallel invasion going on from Crimea up into Kherson province in the south. Russian aviation were systemically smashing airfields. And people were already dying in the early hours of the invasion. And I remember going down to Kyiv's Independence Square about 6 a.m. It was cold, by the way. It was a cold, chilly, grey Thursday morning. And I had my flak jacket on. And then I wore a woolly hat because my helmet was a bit too heavy. There was almost no one there. And I was taking photographs of the centre of Kyiv just reflexively because I didn't know how long it would last. Because really, most people, not just most Ukrainians, but most people in London, in Washington, in Berlin, in Paris, they thought that Ukraine would not stand. They thought it would fall. And the plan, the Putin plan, absolutely was to take Kyiv, to kill Zelensky. Special forces were going to shoot him in the head and kill all of his cabinet, seize the presidential administration, raise the Russian tricolor above Independence Square, and to wipe out Ukraine as a country, as an entity, as a culture, as a language, as a civilization. And as Stalin did in the 1930s, the goal was to kill its poets, its intellectuals, its teachers, its artists. There was a whole generation called the Executed Renaissance in the 1930s. So it was history repeating itself. And the other thing Putin planned to do was to stage a triumphant parade down the Kreshchatyk, the main boulevard in Kyiv. I kid you not, there were tanks which were recovered during fighting in the Kyiv region where the Ukrainians found parade uniforms, dress uniforms. And Putin's sort of spy agencies told him this operation would take about 3 days. And then Ukraine, there'll be some resistance, but it would be kind of quelled. You know, and of course that didn't happen. The Ukrainians fought back bravely and valiantly and smartly. They managed to blow up an airport just north of Kyiv, which was supposed to be the bridgehead for these invading forces. They ambushed Russian military columns as they trundled through the pine forests around Chernobyl. And what we've seen is this kind of enormous fight back ever since. At the same time that in occupied areas, in areas that Russia managed to occupy in the first months of the conflict, including Mariupol, we've seen tens of thousands of Ukrainian civilians have been killed. And I think it's pretty clear. I think we can say that Putin's project in Ukraine is essentially fascist. And I don't use that word lightly. It's a fascist project to subjugate Ukrainians, to de-Ukrainize Ukraine, and to turn it back into a kind of Russian colony. And his view is that either Ukrainians will yield, accept Russia as master, or they can be exterminated. And so, as you know, for The Guardian in my book, I write about Bucha, the town just outside Kyiv where Russian soldiers executed civilians. I went to meet the aunt of a 24-year-old guy who was taken away by Russian soldiers on the back of an armored personnel carrier. And the soldiers told this guy's mother, he was called Sergei Chernochenko. They told Sergei's mother, we'll bring him back. And so for 3 weeks, she believed he was alive. And then at the end of March 2022, they withdrew. And she found his body 300 meters away in a basement just around the corner from where she lived. And he'd been padlocked in this basement. He'd been tortured. And one night, these soldiers themselves, aged 20, 21, 22, had made him kneel and they'd shot him in the back of the head. This happens everywhere the Russians occupy. There were more than 1,600 people killed in the Kyiv region, civilians. I saw a mass grave outside the church in Bucha. I talked to people in Mariupol, which was basically exterminated back that spring. And really, I've been covering the conflict for The Guardian ever since. I spent 3 weeks in Ukraine, 3 weeks here, 3 weeks in Ukraine. I've been to Kherson in the south, which was liberated before it was liberated, after it was liberated in the end of 2022. I've been on the east and in the kind of Donetsk region where Russian soldiers have been rolling forward. I've been in Kharkiv many times, which the Russians have bombed remorselessly from the very beginning of the conflict, which they tried and failed to occupy. And I've been trying to write about the politics, the international dimension to this war, but also to tell human stories, to write about soldiers, civilians, older people who find themselves forced to flee, sometimes to kind of re-flee. And just a couple of things quickly about what's going on now before I go to questions. So now there are two big offensives going on. There's a Russian offensive, which has been getting bigger and bigger and bigger, particularly since February, when the Russians seized the eastern city of Avdiivka, where I was back in 2022. They took Avdiivka, and they've carved out this salient, and they're now rolling forward, village by broken village, towards the center of Ukrainian-controlled Donetsk region. It's one of Putin's key goals, and they're now about 11 kilometers away from a major city and logistics hub called Pokrovsk. They're trying to take Pokrovsk at all costs. And the way the Russians are doing this is by doing kind of bloody Second World War style assaults. The Ukrainians call them meat assaults, where they blast a Ukrainian position using aviation, and then they send in groups of soldiers, 8, 10, 12. They all get killed. They send 10 more. They get killed. They send 10 more. And so it goes on. And then they send in tanks. The tanks get blown up. And then they send in more armored vehicles. And eventually they will go forward 500 meters, 800 meters, 1,000 meters. Russia has lost 500,000 soldiers killed or wounded in the last 2.5 years. The total is bigger than the Soviet war in Afghanistan, which went on for more than a decade. It's been a brutal, terrible slaughter of Ukrainians, but also of Russians as well, sent to die. And the picture was pretty grim. The last couple of reporting trips I did to Ukraine, my Ukrainian friends were depressed, demoralized, tired, exhausted, because even if you're not on the front line, what you have to understand is that you go to bed at 11:30, then just as you're falling asleep, you'll hear an air raid siren wailing across the skyline of Kyiv. And you have to work out, what do I do? Do I go back to sleep? Do I go to the basement shelter? And these are sort of existential decisions you're making every single day, not just for you, but for your kids, for your elderly parents, for everybody. So people are weary. The Russians destroyed the electricity grid, so there's not much power. It's been very hot this summer. I think Zelensky decided that he had to do something to try and change the story of the war, the narrative of the war, and to kind of restore morale. And in July of this year, I went to interview General Alexander Sirsky, the commander-in-chief of Ukraine's armed forces, at a secret location in the south of Ukraine. I can't tell you where it was, but it was quite funny because it was all a bit cloak and dagger. We had to be at a certain place at a certain time. I had to leave my laptop behind, my phone behind, went in a kind of mud-covered van, and I thought we were going to drive for hours through the countryside to the front line, and we drove for 3 minutes into a building, and there he was, General Sirsky. By the way, we should applaud General Sirsky. Today he was made a full general, four-star general, the highest rank awarded by Zelensky. So go General Sirsky. But anyway, I sat with him, and I said, well, what are you going to do? You're losing. And he said, well, that's not quite true, but the Russians have more of everything. We are outmanned, outgunned. They have more soldiers. They have more armored vehicles. They have more tanks. They have more aviation, better air defenses, electronic warfare. And he said, well, I've got a plan. And I said, well, what is your plan? And he said, it's a military secret. I can't tell you. And I thought, okay, that's what generals say when Western reporters ask them impudent questions. I've got a plan. But it turned out he did have a plan, and his plan was to launch this extraordinary, audacious, counteroffensive incursion into the Kursk region of Russia, which is next to northeast Ukraine. And it began on August the 6th. It went better than anyone had expected. Ukraine now controls about 1,250 square kilometers of Russian territory, 93 settlements. It's the first time Russia has been invaded by foreign troops since 1941 and Operation Barbarossa, launched by Nazi Germany. And it has been embarrassing for Putin, humiliating for Putin. He's kind of pretending it's not happening and is just trying to ignore it. There's fierce fighting going on, and more than 100,000 Russians have fled. And I think it's a really interesting gamble. I mean, it's absolutely a gamble, but I think this operation was conceived when it looked as if Donald Trump was coming back to the White House, would win the US presidential election in November, and would ring up Zelensky and say, let's do a deal. You give Putin everything he's got, and I'll tell him to stop fighting, and look, I've made a deal. Clearly that deal wouldn't work. Too many Ukrainians have died. Too many people have lost husbands, sons, friends, for any deal of that kind to stick. And plus, Putin would use any pause in the fighting to attack again. But I think they did this Kursk invasion so that if Trump does win, they have something to negotiate. They have something to swap. So it's quite canny, but we don't know how it's going to finish. But morale has lifted. People have cheered up. There's something incredibly energizing if you're a Ukrainian to see Russian flags being chucked down from the top of high buildings, or Russian soldiers ripping down portraits of Putin and chucking them in the bin. So it's a very interesting moment in this incredibly kinetic war. And I just want to make sort of two last points before we go to questions. One is, just to say what is at stake. I mean, I think if you look at the international scene, what we see is an alliance between Russia and China and Iran, which is supplying Russia with drones, and North Korea, which has sent 1 million artillery shells, as well as sort of diplomatic support from other rogue regimes like Venezuela. There's a very good historian and journalist called Anne Applebaum, who's just published a book called Autocracy, Inc. And it's how authoritarian states, totalitarian states, are cooperating. They're cooperating over CCTV. They're cooperating over information sharing. They cooperate on propaganda, on trolling. And it's almost non-ideological. So you can have a supposedly left-wing government in Venezuela cooperating with what I would say is a far-right, ultra-nationalist, fascist regime in Russia. Because really what they're opposing is Western democracy and the idea of Western democracy. And what Putin's been trying to do for a long time is to sabotage and subvert our democracy, to buy our politicians, to give money to certain political parties via proxies. I mean, I don't know if any of you are lawyers, so I won't name the political party, but you can probably guess which British political party has taken oligarch donations over the last 10, 15 years. But basically to kind of sabotage us. That's been the plan. And I think what's at stake in Ukraine is more than, it's, you have to think about it as more than a kind of regional conflict between two unhappy neighbors. It really is a kind of battle for where the world order, where the international system goes in the 21st century, whether we have still a kind of functioning democratic world where we believe in democracy, the right to get rid of your government, to evict bad or corrupt politicians, whether we believe in self-determination, freedom, you know, and not in a kind of neocon sense, but just the freedom to be without being persecuted or bugged or surveilled by the state or jailed on fictitious charges. So it's a struggle of Autocracy Inc. against the democratic world. I mean, the good news is I think the coalition supporting Ukraine has been pretty robust. I watched a video this morning of Keir Starmer sending Ukrainians congratulations for Independence Day. He got everything right that the UK flag, the Ukrainian flag, the only thing he couldn't say Slava Ukraini very well. Someone needs to coach him on that. But the sentiment is good. So I think there's a clash between two visions of the world, the kind of Putin vision, which essentially is nihilistic, where big countries, powerful countries can overrule, invade smaller countries, where some countries are sovereigns, other countries like Ukraine, as he sees it, are not sovereign. And the liberal model. So that's what's at stake. And just one last thing to say, which is that I think Kyiv now, I mean, I spent a lot of time in Kyiv. I've got friends in Kyiv. I think about Kyiv in the way, you know, some of you are young, but some of you are not so young and perhaps remember the Cold War. Is that right? Yeah, okay. Think about Kyiv as kind of Berlin. It's as Berlin was in the 1970s and 1980s. It's an incredibly creative, dynamic place that is very much part of Europe, European civilization, but which is under threat from a totalitarian attack. And so I think the future of Europe for sure will be determined in Kyiv. I think not this year, but certainly in the next few years. And I would just urge you to support Ukraine, to support Kyiv, to not switch off, to be engaged, because their struggle is our struggle. It's about decency. It's about compassion. It's about humanity. Thank you.
Thank you, Luke, for taking us kind of through your eyes to the front line, to the streets of Kyiv, and giving us such a profound account of that. We've got time for questions now. I'm sure there will be lots of you with questions. So can I encourage you to keep your questions concise and to the point? I will try and take a range of people. I have some meters of cord on this, so I will get as near to you as I can. You may need to come a bit forward. Okay, I will start with you.
I'll hold the microphone. Does Putin have plans for the Baltic states, and will NATO membership protect them?
Does Putin have plans for the Baltic states?
What? Does Putin have plans for the Baltic states, and will NATO protect them?
He does. He does, and this is the argument that Zelensky and other people use, and I find it pretty convincing that if Russia wins in Ukraine, he won't stop. I mean, really, he believes that Eastern Europe, Central Europe, is part of Russia's zone of influence, as it was in Soviet times, in communist times, where there are a whole lot of Warsaw Pact satellite states stretching from Tallinn to Bucharest and so on. So the kind of physical seizing of territory, which is the project in Ukraine. It's military, but it's also about reasserting Russia's influence. He would like nothing better than to reoccupy the Baltic states. He thinks they're sub-sovereign. He doesn't think they're real countries. And of course, for 50 years, they were part of the kind of Russian Imperium or the Red Russian Imperium. There's also Kaliningrad. I don't know if people know where Kaliningrad is, but Königsberg. It's this weird Russian exclave, so it's not connected by land to Russia, next to Poland and Lithuania, and there's a corridor which is about 70 kilometers long, and if he could actually create a corridor, he could rejoin Kaliningrad with the rest of Russia. That's very much a project. It's not a now project, but it's a future project. And I think the really alarming scenario is if Donald Trump wins again. At the moment, it looks like possibly he won't, but he still might. Then, for now, I think NATO is protecting the Baltic states, to answer your question. But if Trump wins, what I can see is I wouldn't see a full-scale invasion of Latvia, say, or Estonia. I would see some kind of border incident which Russia blames on the West or on the Baltic states to test the water to see what President Trump 2 does. And if Trump does nothing, then other kind of options are in play. So we have to hope Trump loses and Kamala Harris wins.
Hi, It's a slightly personal question. I housed a Ukrainian refugee for 9 months from Odessa region. How widespread is the war affecting people in the country? We want to get sort of very localised news from the any...
Did people hear that or not? Okay, so the lady hosts a Ukrainian refugee and wants to know how widespread is the conflict and does it affect the Odessa region, which is where she's from. I mean, the answer is the war affects everybody. So, I mean, even in Kiev, and Odessa too, I spent a lot of time in Odessa, it kind of looks and feels normal-ish. I mean, there are cafes, there are restaurants, there are people walking their dog. In Odessa, there is a feral cat population. It's like something out of Bulgakov with several thousand homeless cats fed by an army of old ladies who will just, by the promenade, you know, they will feed them. It's a magical city with acacia trees, with a view of the Black Sea, and it feels like you are in a short story. But it's also being whacked quite frequently by Russian missiles, not as badly as some areas in the east, but people are killed. You know, rogue missiles will get through air defenses and land on residential blocks, killing families, killing kids, killing everybody. And the sort of psychological pressure when you're in Ukraine, even when you're not in Ukraine, because a lot of women who are here have husbands fighting in the armed forces, so they're physically here, their kids are physically here, but they're looking at their phone all the time. They're waiting for news, they're waiting for updates, they're worrying. So it affects everybody. And also, the really tragic thing is that each time I go back, I find Ukrainian friends who know someone who's been killed, either a relative or a friend or a guy they're at college with. And me too. That wasn't true in 2022. Now it's true. So we don't know how many Ukrainian soldiers have died, but I mean, the official figure is about 33,000, but the reality is much, much higher. So the war affects everybody. And can I just say thank you to you for hosting a Ukrainian refugee? Thank you.
I'm just wondering what we can do locally ourselves here in the UK. We also sponsor and host Ukrainians. We had a young lady, 14 years old, who was absolutely petrified with thunder a couple of weeks ago. Somebody said to her, "Oh, don't worry, it's only God moving the furniture around. Just make it as a joke." Yeah. And the young girl was absolutely petrified to say, and she said, "Well, it sounds like bombs." Now, whenever the war stops and whatever happens to Ukraine, it's going to take years, maybe decades, to rebuild. But rebuilding the mental anxiety of people, maybe the Ukrainians here in the UK, that's going to take much longer. What can we do to help and support and encourage that now for the future?
Yeah, I mean, again, thank you for what you're doing. I mean, I would just sort of repeat what I said earlier, which is to stick with it. Because as you say, I mean, the war is not going to finish this year. I don't think it's going to finish next year. I think it could be, I mean, it's already gone on since 2014. And I think so long as Vladimir Putin is in the Kremlin, and he's 71 years old and he's got very good medical care. There were rumors a couple of years ago he was dying. He's obviously not dying. There are rumors that he uses clones, doubles. That appears to be true, actually. If you look at some of the photos this week, there was one Putin that went to Chechnya, another went to Azerbaijan, and one that held a meeting in Moscow. Certainly the Chechen one really... I mean, you look more like Putin than than that guy did. I mean, sorry, I don't mean to be frivolous, but I think you know, keep going. All I would say is keep going. And you know, the 14-year-old, she could be here in 5 years' time. You know, so even if people sort of formally move out, stay in touch. You know, ask after their lives, inquire, help where you can. And you know, the Ukrainian refugees, I mean, they're like us. They're very different and diverse, and some have done terrifically well and have found it quite easy. Others have struggled. Just keep going and keep alive the idea that but for an accident of geography and DNA, that could be you. It could be you, or it could be someone you know and love. And so, carry on. I tell you what, if you come forward, you could do the question after this one.
I would say first, thank you. I have a friend who currently lives in Kyiv. Anna, if you can keep her in your prayers, that would be amazing. The main thing I want to do is, how do you keep on with the news without, like, getting extremely upset? Specifically someone who has people who left Ukraine and still in Ukraine now. It's so difficult to, like, keep going and watching the news without, like, getting upset.
How do I keep going?
Yeah.
Okay.
In general, how do you think?
Well, I mentioned my cool wife. I mean, and my cool family, that helps. I think being able to come back and decompress. Humor is very important. I sort of have a routine in when I'm in, you know, the front line. We have a very good team. So when I'm reporting for The Guardian from the front line, we bought a Land Cruiser. I've got a wonderful Ukrainian driver called Oleg. I have a security guy called Jake. I've got a brilliant Italian photographer called Alessio. Who's from Sicily. We make lots of Italian jokes. He makes lots of British jokes. And when you're on the front line, you get an adrenaline rush. I mean, there's no doubt about that. You can be shelled within about 15 kilometers of the front line. So just a bit shy of that, we will stop in a lay-by. We will put our flat jackets on, helmets on. We'll wind the windows down. We'll undo seatbelts because sometimes you need to kind of run very quickly. And what's interesting about those trips is that you feel and see and remember everything vividly. Every conversation, the people you met, where you met them, what the vegetation looked like, what the sky, whether the smoke in the sky, what it sounded like. You learn to distinguish between outgoing artillery, Ukrainian artillery, which is like the thunder your 14-year-old was describing. It's like a thunderclap. It's not okay, but it's kind of okay. And incoming, which is a whistle. If you hear a whistle, you're in trouble and you need to move very, very quickly. And you say a little prayer, actually. Not just for yourself, but for everyone in that situation. And I don't know. I mean, I find I write better somehow when I do those trips, because you see people living in that situation and you understand. You're not thinking, you're thinking analytically, but you're also thinking emotionally, empathically about them. And just one last remark is that you know, I revere, you know, the seniors of Ukraine, older people, but sometimes there is a moment they have to leave their home and come somewhere safer. I mean, quite often people will stay really until the very last minute when it's a bit late. Sorry, you're having to sort of stage dive here, really, aren't you? You're doing very well.
Thank you. It's only a quick-in. It was really in response to the gentleman at the front. One of the things that we're doing from the Leeds Diocese, I'm from the Mothers Union in the Leeds Diocese, and we are making out a plea for old wax, old candles. And what happens, and there's a lot in churches, in cupboards, there's a lot of wax. And it comes to me, and then I take it to a Ukrainian lady, and she boils it all down in a big, big pan. And then we also take small cans of mushy peas or baked beans, the small size, and she makes those into candles. They're taken over by a transit van, along with clothes and various other things. And then they go to the soldiers in the trenches to keep them warm, to make them, allow them to boil a cup of tea or whatever, and to light the trenches. So that's just something that we can do. And it makes us feel more useful rather than useless.
Thank you.
And just to add, I've seen those candles on the front line. I mean, they really are used. They are useful. And thank you very much.
Luke. Thanks very much. Can I ask what your response is to the claim that some have made that Putin's behaviour is in response to provocation from the West?
The short answer is, it's not true. If you look at the history of Ukraine and Russia, as Ukrainians see it, and really I share the view, it's been one of repression and erasure going back centuries. The first edict by the Russian authorities against the Ukrainian language, I'll give you Well, I'll tell you, it was 1622. There were a series of anti-Ukrainian language edicts in the 19th century where Ukrainian couldn't be performed on stage, Ukrainian poetry was outlawed. The national bard, Ukraine Shakespeare, Taras Shevchenko, whose poetry all Ukrainians know by heart, was imprisoned. And then, of course, we had the kind of the baleful 20th century, and in particular the Holodomor, Stalin's artificial famine of 1932 and 1933, where about 5 million Soviet Ukrainians died, perished, because of forced collectivization. So it's a long history of Russia suppressing Ukraine's right to exist, right to language, right to build a society and culture of its own, to have representation. Normally the way that argument goes, it was kind of NATO's fault. You know, NATO provoked Russia. The reality is that NATO is just a kind of pretext, and it's much pushed by Russian propaganda. But the fact is that as you know, Finland and Sweden have both joined NATO after the war in Ukraine, and Russia's entirely indifferent to that. It's not actually about NATO at all. It's the project in Ukraine is a neo-imperial project, as I said, to kind of restore a kind of great Russia and imperial Russia. And it's also very much Putin's personal project. I mean, there's no point in being too counterfactual, but if Putin were not there, if there were perhaps a less kind of extreme, a less monomaniacal leader, then the war would not have happened. It's very much his war. Albeit that many Russians believe it and believe what they see on TV.
Hi, this is a question about sanctions, which have dropped off the political agenda, I think. Do you have a feel for whether any Western sanctions have had any tangible effect now or maybe in the future? And whether Europe is still importing some Russian gas? I read recently it was still 15%, but isn't talked about.
Yeah, a really good question. I mean, basically, I think sanctions after the full-scale invasion were the right thing to do. They're still the right thing to do. They haven't been terribly effective, as you know. I mean, if you want to be nerdish about it, if you look at German car exports to Kyrgyzstan since 2022, they've gone up about 700% because the German cars go to Kyrgyzstan and then, of course, they're shipped to Russia. So there have been lots of ways around it. Russia has sold a huge amount of discounted oil to India. Narendra Modi was in Kiev yesterday, actually meeting Zelensky. But India presents itself as a neutral party, but has had a pretty close relationship with Russia, both historically and now. The one area which I kind of personally rejoice in is the fact that as a journalist for The Guardian, I used to get endless letters from Russian oligarchs, angry letters written by lawyers in London charging £2,000 an hour to send me abusive letters saying, you have described I won't name any names because they've got a long reach, these guys, but you've described my client as an oligarch. The only wording we think is acceptable is American philanthropist, you know, because they, and it's like, so we're and we used to get these insane letters from I can name the legal firms, from Carter Ruck, from Mishkon Daraya, from Shillings. And it used to be a huge part of my job was to make sure that everything we published was legally watertight and defendable. They all got sanctioned, or most of them got sanctioned in 2022. A certain oligarch had to sell Chelsea Football Club, which, by the way, belonged to someone else who occupies a high position in the Russian Federation. Let's put it like that. And that kind of legal jeopardy that we always face has gone away. And those oligarchs, you know, for them, for a long time under all governments, it was Londongrad. They could launder money here. They could invest here. They could buy property here. They could buy British politicians here, particularly in the House of Lords, donate to political parties through proxies. As I said, that era is over. And they played a double game where at home they were supporters of Vladimir Putin and staunch patriots. And abroad, they were philanthropists and entrepreneurs. And they had no connection with the Russian state. And that's gone. And I'm grateful for that.
I wanted to ask a question about the recent tensions between the Polish and Belarusian border. Do you think that's straight from the Kremlin, or like, yeah?
I mean, that's a really interesting question. We don't talk enough about Belarus. I mean, briefly, there's a kind of violent campaign to annex and take over all of Ukraine. We know about that, but there's been a kind of softer and a less noticed project to basically absorb Belarus and make it
de facto, if not de jure, part of Russia, part of Russian space. And you'll remember that the Kremlin saved Alexander Lukashenko, the dictator of Belarus, about 3-4 years ago when there were mass street protests. And it was essentially with Russian help that he was able to quell them and put them down. So what's been happening on the Polish-Belarus border is that a lot of refugees from the Middle East, from Kurdistan, from Iraq, and so on, have been traveling to Belarus, many of them on packages kind of arranged by the Russians and Belarus authorities, where they fly directly to Minsk, they then bus to the border, and they then try and cross into Poland, the European Union. And this is a problem. It's a problem for the Polish authorities. And also, it's incredibly cynical, because they're trying to kind of instrumentalize refugees and use them as a weapon, weaponize them against the West, and try and overwhelm the system in Europe, because they know that immigration is a really explosive issue, and that the Putin playbook is to try and divide democratic societies so that instead of agreeing or having a civilized conversation or finding a reasonable compromise, we just shout at each other all the time and we engage in culture war on a number of issues. Immigration is one, you know the others. So it's cynical, it's clever. The Poles have built a wall, and I feel very sorry for the guys who are involved, because they're being used.
Sorry, do you see Israel Zionists as part of this, what did you call it, Autocracy Inc?
It's an interesting question, and I'm not dodging it, but I have to say that some of my colleagues have been reporting from Jerusalem. They've been writing about events in Gaza, and I sat down with my boss after you know, October of last year, and I said, look, I can only do one full-blown, crazy, dark story. I can't go from Kiev and then go to Jerusalem, because it's just too much. So I haven't reported from there directly. So my answer is kind of provisional, I think Israel is a kind of entity to itself. What's interesting, what I just say in terms of Israel-Ukraine, is you would think that Israel would support Ukraine in its struggle, and would supply it with air defenses, perhaps, or advanced missiles or military hardware. It hasn't done any of that, even though Zelensky's position has been very pro-Israeli, including in recent months, somewhat controversially. And I think Netanyahu had this kind of unhealthy relationship with Putin, or kind of understanding, perhaps, not least because the Russians are very, very active in Syria. And I don't quite know where we're at, but what I would, you know, ignoring Palestine, not ignoring it, but just parking it, perhaps, I would hope that Israel would do more to support Ukraine.
Hi, I just had a question about the kind of West posture with regards to how aggressive we've been, speaking for us all. And do you think that's a sensible posture? And do you think...
Sorry, what do you mean by aggressive?
Are we aggressive enough? Do you think we've been aggressive enough?
Okay.
And also with the making available of hard military systems, do you think that's limited the aspiration of the Ukrainians in their offensive or not? So if we kind of put the handbrake on their aspirations, if you like.
Yeah, I mean, there's an interesting conversation, and I talked to Zelensky about this when I saw him in May, or at least he mentioned it at length, which is that, as I'm sure you know, the Biden administration has restricted the use of long-range systems inside Russia. And the Brits, we are a bit more hawkish on this, I think, but my understanding, having talked to a few people, you know, from the Ministry of Defense, is that we do what the Americans tell us to some extent, or at least where we don't sort of cut we don't make decisions which are at variance with their decisions. So the three countries which supply long-range weaponry to Ukraine, so that's the French, the Brits, the Americans, still haven't lifted this embargo. It's a red line. Now, what Zelensky has been saying, and one of the reasons that they did this Kursk offensive, is that to say these red lines are meaningless. We now control a chunk of Russia. There are American Humvees running around the Kursk countryside, and we need these weapons to destroy Russian military infrastructure sites, airfields, munitions, warehouses, fuel depots, and so on. So it's an active conversation going on. I think we should lift all restrictions. I also think, I am left-wing, I am progressive, but I hate to say it, but I think we need to be building more arms factories or more shells. So that seems a very strange thing to say, but I think actually our own armed forces have been really run down quite badly over the last 10 years. And in a world where you have very unpredictable actors like Russia going on, where Russian dissidents are being murdered. I wrote a book about this, by assassins in London using radioactive cups of tea. We can't assume that everything will work out. So we should lift restrictions. We should continue to support Ukrainians. And we should understand this is going to be a long conflict.
Thank you very much. We are, I'm afraid, now slightly over time. So I'm probably going to draw us to a close. I'm really sorry to all those of you who've had your hands up who you haven't been able to take. I took a question from you yesterday, sir, so that's why I haven't come back to you. But thank you, Luke.
Thank you. I mean, just to say, I'll sign books in the tent. I'll wander over there now. So if anyone wants to kind of ask the question they couldn't ask, you can kind of find me over there for the next hour or so. So we can talk further. Thank you.
Give Luke a huge hothouse. Thank you very much. Shared with us.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.